Suicide? He looked at me with disdain. Kipling, actually. But there's no shame in suicide, detective. It's only milksop Christianity that clucks with disapproval. The Romans and the Greeks saw suicide largely as a pragmatic act, a graceful and courageous exit when life has become unendurable. Ah, I think Captain King's coming now. A black hearse was moving slowly down the high street. In the back was a coffin wrapped in a Union Jack. Suicide didn't seem like a pragmatic act for James Sutcliffe, I said, watching the first of the flowers being tossed from the pavement. They fell on the windscreen, they fell on the gleaming black hood, and they fell under the slowly turning wheels. For him, suicide seemed like an act of despair, both times. War sighed, his eyes never leaving the hearse. I'm afraid I have no idea what goes on in the mind of every disturbed adolescent, he said, but I'm with the Romans and the Greeks. Every human body is the property of the gods. Good day, detective. I thought that the headmaster was going to join Ben King in his blood-stained army jacket. Then I thought he might stand with the stiff, fierce lines of the combined cadet force. Instead, he disappeared into the crowd, and the next time I saw him, he was standing beside a small, snivelling Potter's Field boy. War had placed a large white hand on the shoulder of the boy's green and purple blazer. I saw the headmaster's mouth move. There, there, he seemed to be saying. There, there. The hearse was passing now. The windscreen wipers swishing once, twice, three times to clear the driver's view of the flowers that threatened to cover the glass. Roses, orchids, lilies. Expensive flowers bought and thrown by the people of the town. The boys of Potter's Field brought no flowers for the homecoming of Captain Ned King. But later, as I walked through the deserted school grounds past the chapel and into the small graveyard, I saw that someone had placed a single lily on the tomb of King Henry's dogs. Chapter 33. Saturday morning in Smithfield ABC. I was down on the mat stretching my back. Upward facing dog, hold it. Downward facing dog, hold it. The pain seemed to release itself. It still hurt, but I was not contained in one tight slab. It was looser. It was better. I could feel it. This was the quiet time in Fred's gym. Otis Redding on the sound system and the sound of 14-ounce gloves smacking pads. There was a young woman banging the heavy bag, an older woman watching the business news as she ran on the treadmill, and up in the ring, Fred, wearing a T-shirt that told you, play hard or go home, as he took some kid in his late teens on the pads. North African, a big, toothy grin, either a pro or thinking about it. The kid was fast, slick, hitting the pads very hard without apparently making much of an effort. Get that right all the way back to the chin, Fred was telling him. Don't let it fade away. And don't stand there taking photographs. Get out when you've done your work. And throw punches in bunches. Punches in bunches. When the bell rang, Fred would look down at me, the pads still on his hands. And he would name the part of my body that needed to be stretched. Hamstring. Calves. Abductors. Did you do your abductors? Do your abductors! I laid the front of my left leg on a bench, placed my right foot on the ground and gently eased my shoulders back, feeling the stretch in the muscles at the top of my leg and the bottom of my spine. Then, Ben King walked in. The woman on a heavy bag looked at him, then looked again. It had been a week since he was the lead item on the news, since he was on every front page, since he wore his brother's blood-stained camouflage jacket on the rolling news. Satisfied it was really him, the woman looked away and went back to her work on the heavy bag. He was dressed for a run. I wasn't party to anything that happened at Potter's Field, he said to me, a beat. But I know who was. I eased myself out of the stretch and sat on the bench. You're coming forward with new information? Yes. Why didn't you come forward before now? King turned his head as a buzzer sounded in the ring.
Time!
Shouted Fred. Ben King looked back at me. Because I love my brother. Do you know the identity of the man who killed Hugo Buck? No. Adam Jones, Guy Phillips? No. Salman Khan? That was an accident, wasn't it? Fire. What happened to Anya Bauer? Who's Anya Bauer? I stood up and took a fistful of his T-shirt near the neck. He didn't flinch. Are you wasting my time? I said. He shook his head. No. Who was Anya Bauer? I said. What happened to her? I don't know that name. I never knew any name. I never even saw the girl you're talking about, but I know that questionable acts were done at that school. I know, to my eternal regret, that my brother Ned was a party to them. And yes, my friends, too. And I know the name of the adult who instigated those questionable acts, because he was the same man who sexually abused us for years. I still had his T-shirt in my fist. I twisted it until our faces were almost touching. Don't lie to me, I said. I'm past lying, he said. People get lost. My brother Ned got lost. When we were boys, I threw a glass at his face across the breakfast table. Why do you think I threw that glass at his face? Because I loved him. Because of the unspeakable things he was doing. Because of what was happening to him. Because of that man. The headmaster, I said. Peregrine War. Oi! Fred called. He was talking to me. I still had a fistful of Ben King's T-shirt in my hand. Take it in the ring or take it outside. I let go of King's T-shirt. He was smiling. I haven't boxed since school, he said. You boxed at school, I said. Of course. All good schools teach their boys to box. May I borrow these? He was pointing at a pair of yellow 14-ounce Clito Ray's gloves. I shook my head. I don't think that's a good idea, I said. His mouth twisted with amusement. I'm sure you're right. I stared at him for a moment. Find a head guard, I said. He was a boxer, not a fighter. He kept his distance, up on the balls of his feet, dancing sideways as I advanced, and for a moment I thought he had lost his nerve and did not want to fight. Then I stuck out a left jab that fell short, and he came back with a stiff counter that went straight through my guard and smacked hard against my nose. By the time I had angrily swung back, he had skipped away. We repeated our little dance. He would wait for me to strike, then slip, block or move out of range, and come back with a fast, straight counter. The sweat was pouring under my head guard. I had not sparred for weeks, and I could feel my ring rust, that tiny loss of pace you get when you haven't boxed for a while. I was 1 second too slow in everything I did, and nothing is more draining than being hit without having the chance to hit back. A buzzer sounded. 1 minute gone, and his confidence was growing. And that was good, because I jabbed, he countered with a jab and stayed close to smack me with a right cross. It caught me high on the head guard, but not hard enough to stop me slipping inside and burying a left hook into his bottom rib. King went down on one knee, one glove pressed against his ribs, and his face contorted with pain. A body shot sticks around in a way a head shot never does. And when he got to his feet, he was less cocky, keeping his distance, happy to get in the odd counter, happy to stay away from another dig in the ribs. The buzzer counted down from 10 and it was over. We had sparred for 3 minutes and we were both totally spent. Christ, he said, that's harder than squash. Fred was smiling at us. Nice spar, he said. And to Ben King, keep those elbows tucked in. Going to do another couple of rounds? Perhaps some other time, King said, still breathing hard. Fred laughed and went off to collect the towels that were strewn around the gym. King and I sat there saying nothing, drenched in sweat, locked in the strange intimacy of two men who've just shared a boxing ring. What do you want, Max? He said. I want justice, I said, and I want the truth, and I want it to be over. He fixed me with his politician's look. That look that suddenly saw you, the look that endlessly flattered you, the look that saw you in your true light for the first time. "And I want what you want," he said. "The abuse started as soon as we arrived," King said. "Mental abuse before the sexual abuse. Shakespeare is here, T.E. Lawrence is here, and you are here because you are nothing. You are specks of dirt on my shoes." And then the building up, feeling you were special, almost acolytes, by this godlike and punitive father figure who knew everything there was to know about history, art, literature, war, and the ways of the flesh. We were 13 years old. There was, shall we say, a disparity of power. We wanted to please him. My God, we wanted that more than anything in the world. The grey ribbon of motorway hummed and unfurled ahead of me, eating up the miles. I let him talk. And he gave us all what we were looking for. The insecure Adam, Salman, were made to feel as if they belonged, as if they were part of a family, a country, a secret world. The strong, Hugo, Ned, Guy, were made to feel they were clever. The exceptional, James, of course, were made to feel that they were touched by God. And he told us we were special, and he taught us to sneer at the rest of the world, and he talked of beauty and truth as he put us in his mouth. He was silent for miles. "I bailed out," King said eventually. "I don't know why it was possible for me and not the others. Some basic survival instinct I had, and they lacked. They were all exceptional boys in their own way. James was brilliant, truly gifted. Adam was a child prodigy. Hugo was the school's athlete. Guy, Piggy, was a force of nature. And Salman was so touching, trying so hard to fit in, so determined, so much more English than the rest of us. And everyone loved Ned. Ned was good."
"Why did you throw the glass at his face?"
"They were getting older. It was no longer enough to perform sexual acts on the headmaster in his study and then sit down for a chapter of the Seven Pillars of Wisdom. They were curious. They were growing boys. Hugo and Guy had been caught in town with a couple of local girls. Women, grown women, went wild at the sight of James." He laughed. "And Piggy was masturbating himself into a coma every night." He chewed his bottom lip. "It was a world without women. So he told them that he would find them one, a woman, a girl, and let them see how little they were missing."
"What did your brother tell you about the girl?"
"He told me she was being given as a special treat." A pause, which was the exact moment I threw the glass at Ned's face, and after that, he told me nothing. I turned off the motorway. In the distance, across the empty fields, you could already see the black towers of Potter's Field. The boy was small for his age, and he wore a Potter's Field school blazer over his fencing whites. He sat on the steps of the main building, pushing back his mop of dark hair as he stared at the paperback in his hands.
"Any good?"
Ben King said.
The boy looked up, startled. "Sir? Book? Any good?"
King held out his hand and the boy passed him the paperback, standing up as he did so, self-consciously smoothing his green and purple blazer.
"The Seven Pillars of Wisdom by T.E. Lawrence," King said.
He opened it up and read, as if to himself. "But at last, down drew me. Come and smell the very sweetest scent of all." And we went into the main lodging, to the gaping window sockets of its eastern face, and there drank with open mouths of the effortless, empty, eddyless wind of the desert, throbbing past.
"I read this one when I was your age. How are you getting on with it?"
"Just started it, sir. Pretty good stuff, sir."
King nodded at him.
"Waiting to see the master?"
"Sir?
Private lesson today?"
A red flush flooded the boy's pale face.
Yes, sir. Every Saturday morning this half, immediately after fencing club."
King handed the boy his book.
"Lessons cancelled. Sir, go back to your house, practice your lunge and parry, do your prep.
write to your mother.
The boy looked doubtful.
King clapped his hands once.
Go on, then.
The boy went, and we climbed the stairs to the headmaster's rooms. Peregrine War answered the door in a plain white kimono. His bliss-heavy eyes took a moment to focus. A smile leapt to his face at the sight of Ben King and died when he saw me.
Ah, he said.
We followed him inside. Heavy brocade curtains pulled shut at noon. A thick fog of smoke from whatever had been in the water pipe that sat unlit on an oak desk. Piles of books everywhere.
To what do I owe?
Actually, we've come here for the truth, Perry, King told him. Finally. I couldn't breathe in this place. I pulled back the curtains, opened the windows as wide as they would go. On the playing fields, there was the first 15 playing rugby against another school, watched by a scattering of pupils and two sportsmasters, and more boys in bright training bibs carrying cones and five-a-side nets to the football pitch. Their shouts and laughter drifted up to me.
The truth? You wouldn't dare. Think of your career, Benjamin. The Right Honourable Member for... What's the name of that dreary little suburb you represent? It slipped my mind.
Hillingdon North, King said. War dropped backwards onto a red velvet sofa, pulling primly at his kimono as one hairy leg with the dimensions of a small tree popped into view. And then, again, the savagery of the despot, who has no experience of being challenged.
You would not dare.
The world is changing, Perry, King said calmly.
Really?
War said. How unfortunate.
It is for you, Perry,
because we're finally learning not to despise the victims of abuse. He let it sink in. You broke a bond of trust. You abused the children in your care.
Genius makes its own rules.
King shook his head. If you have a genius, Perry, then it's for destroying the lives of children. How many would you say, over the years?
Ratting me out, are you, Benjamin? You little snitch. You little sheet. You grass.
Is that the correct term?
Everybody hates a telltale king.
Hundreds?
Oh, more. Thousands. An MP, Bohr laughed. A politician. And I wanted greatness for you, remember?
Measuring the air with a languid hand.
The good old days. Shakespeare is here, T.E. Lawrence is here, and you boys are here.
Oh, Perry, King said.
Then where does that leave you?
I picked up the pipe and breathed in, inhaling something that stank like a curry made of gasoline and flowers, a heavy, musky, strangely beautiful smell. I had never smelled it before. I had only heard tales.
Opium, I said.
War sniffed.
The honey of the gods, he said, smiling to reveal a jumble of crumbling teeth, like the mouth of an elderly weasel. The keys of paradise, the gardens of gold. Boy, as you love me, I charge you to fold pipe over pipe into gardens of gold.
Did you ever read Aleister Crowley, detective? No? Not your thing?
I crossed the room. What happened to the girl? I said.
The headmaster looked genuinely perplexed.
I thought we were talking about the boys. I thought that's what you were going to arrest me for, the boys. I thought that's why I was being thrown to the baying mob. The thousands of boys. What bloody girl?
The open palm of my hand cracked against his cheek.
Ouch, he said,
recoiling as if I'd hurt feelings more than flesh.
That was very painful.
Anya Bauer, I said. German, blonde, pretty, around 15 years old when she passed through your hand some 20 years ago.
Oh, he said, that girl.
His eyes darted across the floor, then he closed them. she rests. She sleeps, perchance to dream.
Where? I said. He was looking at Ben King.
What do you expect me to do, Benjamin? Beg for forgiveness? Seek counselling? Repent my sins?
What would the Romans have recommended, Perry? King said. Or the Greeks? Or T.E. Lawrence?
I don't know. A cup of tea and a nice lie down.
I slapped him again harder this time, leaving my red mark livid on his skull-like head.
Where?
I said.
With the dogs, he said. With the bloody dogs.
The dogs?
You've hurt me now, he said,
edging away from me, gathering his kimono in his long bony fingers.
Truly, I'm very upset. Police brutality.
And then he began to snivel with self-pity. He turned to King, pleading.
May I change? Before we leave? Ben?
Look at me, I said quietly. War looked at me.
What did you do to her? I said.
He gathered the neck of his kimono.
I never touched the little tart, he said. Not until it was time to put her down.
Nobody else had the stomach for it. King was looking at me, struggling to breathe.
My God, he said,
white-faced with shock.
My God.
Your keys, I said to War. I need all the keys to this place. Move. He moved stiffly across to his desk, rummaged for a while in a drawer, then gave me two sets of keys. One was a little domestic set for War's front door and car. The other could have been a jailer's keys from a fairy tale, perhaps 24 of every shape and age on a rust-flecked metal hoop, apparently the means of access to every door in Potter's Field. When I had double-locked them inside War's rooms, I stuffed both sets of keys in my pockets and went quickly down to the chapel and round the back to the old graveyard. I saw now, and for the first time, that there were many gravestones so old that time and weather had erased every word of their epitaphs. Their blank faces stared back at me. My pace slowed and faltered when I saw what someone had done to the tomb of Henry's dogs. I could see it through the ancient trees and the rusting iron railings that guarded the grander tombs. I could see it quite clearly, waiting for me on the far side of the leaning headstones and the forest of crosses and the cracked grey vaults, watched by the sightless eyes of stone angels. I walked towards a great splash of red and black. Poppies. Someone had completely covered the tomb of King Henry VIII's dogs with poppies. There were poppies in the shape of a cross and poppies in round wreaths of every size, the wreaths of old soldiers and young children, all of them coming apart after spending long winter weeks out in the elements, resting against monuments to the glorious dead. And there were single poppies that had come astray from the wreaths, or perhaps been worn for that week of remembrance in November and then discarded. Where had they all come from? Some must have been collected from the war memorial at Potter's Field, but others must have come from war memorials in the town itself and in surrounding towns. My vision filled with the red and black of the poppies, and even as my mind raced to understand, their message was clear. You are never forgotten. Fighting back an overwhelming urge to turn and run away, I pulled out my phone and called Elsa Olsen, reaching her voicemail. Elsa, I said. It's me, Wolf. Sorry, Saturday and all that. I knelt by the tomb, touched the stone beneath the poppies, so suddenly and unexpectedly cold that it made my blood shiver. And I'll clear this with Whitestone and Swire as soon as I hang up, but I wanted you to be the first to know. I picked up a single poppy and held it in my hand. I need an exhumation certificate. There was a red Lexus parked outside the main building. King's PA, Siri Voss, sat in the driver's seat, tapping away on a phone. She got out when she saw me, wearing jeans and leather jacket, off duty now, her quick smile changing to a frown of concern.
You all right?
Sorry, I said, confused. What are you doing here?
I'm Mr. King's ride back into town, she said. He called me. He doesn't want to waste your time or police resources. Her hand was on my arm. Can I get you anything?
I have to go, I said. Upstairs.
Of course, she hesitated. When you have a chance, when things are better, when this ghastly business is over, I would love to talk to you. Mr. King wants to start a charity in the name of your late colleague, DCI Mallory, a fund for the families of policemen killed in the line of duty. Is that something you would be interested in?
Her hand was on my arm again. It was a strange touch. It stayed there a little too long, yet somehow not long enough.
How's Mrs. Mallory coping? She tried. How's Margaret?
I don't know, I said, and felt a stab of real shame. She smiled and fell in behind me as I climbed the stairs and made my way to the headmaster's rooms. Ben King was sitting at War's desk, his head in his hands, and when he looked up, I saw the tears on his face. I knew that boy, he said. The boy outside. I knew that boy because he was me, and he was Ned, and he was all of us. Siri flew to his side. Where is he? I said. But King was good for nothing now. The pretty PA rocking him like a child as he wept. I moved quickly through the rooms, a feeling of dread rising in my stomach, and then I saw the water coming from under the bathroom door. It was locked from inside, so I slammed my shoulder into it. Nothing. And again, nothing. The water was through my shoes and soaking my feet. I felt an icy calm descend on me as I remembered how to open a locked door quickly. I took a step back to give myself room and kicked the lock as hard as I could. The door flew open with a crack of metal and wood, and I saw one of War's long white arms hanging over the side of the bath, fresh blood pouring from the open veins on his wrist, staining the side of the bathtub and the white tiles of the floor with long crimson streaks. There were soft white towels on heated rails and in little piles stacked neatly under the sink. I snatched them up and, sliding on the sopping floor, pressed them against his open wrists and tied them tight around his limp white arms and then threw them aside and started all over again when, in what seemed like seconds, his blood soaked through. I was screaming and cursing and calling for help as I pressed the towels against the open veins of Peregrine War. It was only when I ran out of towels that I saw the lifeblood had drained from his body, that his eyes were staring at the ceiling without seeing. I stood there, with no breath and no strength to move, until I finally remembered to turn off the hot and cold running water. In the sudden silence, the only sound was the boys down on the playing fields, and, from the room behind me, the subdued sobbing of a grown man. Open it up, DCI Whitestone said. By now the December night was cold and black, but the lamps of the Sokos encircled the tomb and drenched it in blazing light. A bitter wind whipped through the graveyard, rustling dead leaves and the poppies that someone had swept from the grave. A forklift truck was slightly tilted on the slope of the old graveyard, and it seemed to rock dangerously as its long metal fork eased beneath the grey stone of Henry's tomb. The murder investigation team from West End Central stood just behind the Sokos, their mufti evidence of their interrupted weekends. Whitestone was in a parka thrown over jeans and t-shirt, as if she had come straight from home. Gain was in a tracksuit, as if he had come straight from the gym. And Edie Wren was in a short dress and killer heels and complicated hair, as if she had come straight from seeing her married man, or, maybe, trying to forget about him. I saw the chief super exchanging words with Sergeant Lane of Potter's Field, their faces ghost-like in the fierce artificial light. And then I looked back at the tomb as the wheels of the bulldozer fought for purchase in the soft soil. All at once, the great slab of stone came away with the crack of torn granite. It rose in the air, clumps of dirt and cement falling away, and the grave was suddenly open. A dozen officers in protective clothing moved quickly forward, and there were shouts and groans and protests as they heaved the lid of the tomb on its side and eased it up against an ancient oak.
The white-suited SOCOs and the uniformed officers edged forward, but the grave was pitch black, buried in the darkness. Somebody adjusted a light. And there in the earth were the small bones of perhaps a dozen spaniels, their legs as thin as fish bones, their skulls the size of tennis balls, locked for eternity in the embrace of what were unmistakably human remains. Chapter 34. Natasha came down the broad walk in Regent's Park, her perfect face impassive behind dark glasses, long of hair and arms and legs, the little Pekingese chihuahua Cross trotting by her side with a stick in its mouth. And she looked like the one for me. It was 60 hours since we'd found the lonely bones of Anya Bauer. I had not slept and I had not eaten since we'd opened the grave, but after taking Scout to school on the third morning, I knew that I desperately needed to do both. You can go without food and sleep for 3 nights and then you begin to fall apart. A single parent can't afford to fall apart. Then I saw Natasha coming towards me as I was finishing my second bacon sandwich at a table outside the Honest Sausage, and I saw that I needed her even more. "My stalker," she said. "The Merry Widow," I said. "Sorry." "No daughter? No dog?" I looked under the table. I knew I'd forgotten something. "Too bad," she said. "I like your dog and daughter." Susan had abandoned her stick and was snuffling at my hand. "They like you," I said, wondering if it was too much. "My daughter and my dog." "I can't think why."
"Me neither."
She indicated the little Pekingese chihuahua Cross who was eating out of my empty hand. "I didn't know Susan cared for you."
"It's nothing to do with me. Everything to do with my bacon sandwich."
Natasha took off her dark glasses. She seemed younger than I remembered, and not quite as tough as she wanted to be.
"Listen," she said.
Later, as we lay side by side, and I knew her for the first time, my hands moved across those long limbs and skin that was as white and unbroken as snow, and I remembered that I had seen her naked body once before, long ago, the first time we met. She kissed my mouth and read my thoughts, and the traffic down on Marylebone High Street seemed to be coming from some other world. She held my hands and made me feel her, made me know her properly, made me understand what had changed. The bruises were gone.
"I healed," Natasha said.
We loved and slept the day away. I had not slept by someone's side for a long time. It was a delicious feeling, a private world of warmth and safety and longing. But then, too soon, it was time for me to go. I slipped out of the sheets, and the dog at the foot of the bed stirred with annoyance and then went back to sleep. Natasha was half awake, and I sat by her side and smoothed her hair and very softly ran my hands over the smooth warmth of her skin. And all of that seemed to make her more sleepy and smiley.
"Oh, come back to bed," she said. "Don't make me call the cops."
I kissed her arm. "I have to pick up my daughter."
"Then come back tonight, both of you. I'm not a cook, but there are some great restaurants round here. What does Scout like?"
"We have to do something tonight. Family stuff." She hugged me.
"Okay," she said,
waking up a bit now, the real world creeping into this secret room.
"I know you're a father. I know a dad has to do what a dad has to do, right?"
I kissed her cheek, her neck, her mouth. "Right," I said.
"But we'll work it out," she said.
And I believed her. I parked the X5 outside a terraced house on a quiet street in Pimlico. Scout was in the passenger seat, holding Stan in a bouquet of white flowers that was almost as big as her. Lilies and roses and flowers that neither of us knew the name of. Bringing flowers always felt like an imposition to me. A vase had to be found, stems cut, water added, topped up at regular intervals, and 1 week later the dead flowers had to be thrown out. The stinking green water poured away, the vase washed clean. It felt like you were asking a lot of someone when you gave them flowers.
Then Scout grinned at me as we got out of the car. A new smile, a gappy smile, because she had lost two teeth at the bottom, the first of her milk teeth to go. And I knew the flowers didn't matter a damn. What mattered was her, and us, and knowing that coming here was the right thing to do. Scout rang the bell. Stan barked once, then again, his feathery tail revolving with excitement. From beyond the door's frosted glass, I heard the excited yap of a West Highland Terrier. Then I saw the shape of Mrs. Margaret Mallory coming down the hall, and the outline of her face through the frosted glass, and the start of her smile. Chapter 35. Soho was our canteen. It meant that odd, unexpected couples were sometimes seen sharing a meal together in the back street restaurants. PC Billy Green and Dr. Stephen were in a corner table of the Siam Cafe on Fifth Street. Green's hands were no longer bandaged. He was in uniform. I was about to join them when I realised that this was not a chance encounter. This was therapy. "Please," Dr. Stephen said. "Our 50 minutes are just about up, so you're no longer suspended, Max?" I shook my head. "One day you're the cock of the walk, and the next you're a feather duster," I said. "Or is it the other way round?" I joined them. "You found the missing girl," Dr. Stephen said. I nodded. "We just got the results of the forensic autopsy from Elsa Olsen. Identified her body from dental records sent over from Germany. Cause of death was a broken neck. Peregrine War snapped Anya Bauer's neck like she was some kind of wounded animal." "And 20 years later," Green said, "he opens up his veins." "And gets off too lightly," I said. "I wanted to see him in court. I wanted to see him in a cell." We were silent until I nodded at Green's hands. "How you doing, Billy?"
"Doing good," he said. "The pain is easing off. The physio is coming along. My fingers are working better, although the right hand is still a bit stiff. The more exercises I do, the better I feel."
The waitress brought a plate of fruit. I saw that Green's hands were stained black with burns and that he held a fork with difficulty. "Stick with it, Billy," I said. "Stick with all of it." But he didn't want my pity. When a piece of mango slipped from his fork and slid across the table, he stabbed at it repeatedly until he finally speared it. He popped the mango in his mouth and laughed. "Lunch takes a bit longer," he said. Dr. Stephen stared at his plate and then back to Green.
"Funny thing is, they gave me sick leave," Green said, "after the night we got Bob. And I went to Vegas because I always fancied Vegas, so I flew to Vegas."
He paused dramatically.
"But they wouldn't let me in."
Dr. Stephen had obviously heard the anecdote before. I had the impression that Green had told the story many times and that his fellow uniformed policeman had enjoyed the punchline. It was the kind of punchline that coppers would find amusing. "They wouldn't let you in," I said. "You mean into the country when you landed?" He nodded, still looking cheery, still seeing the funny side and assuming that I would see it too. "The Americans fingerprint everyone when they pass through immigration. Part of the tightened security after 9/11, right?" I shrugged. "Okay." Green held up his hands like it was a conjuring trick. "And guess who doesn't have fingerprints anymore? They put me on the first flight home."
I stared at Billy Green's blackened hands, and I kept on staring until he placed them on his lap below the table where I could no longer see them.
"Harry Jackson," said Sergeant John Kane. "People tend to walk right past old Harry Jackson."
It was true. The Black Museum was so full of gory artefacts from the endless variety of firearms and blades that had claimed policemen's lives, to the pots and pans in which serial killers had cooked the flesh of their victims, that it was easy to walk past the small, unassuming display devoted to Harry Jackson. There wasn't much. A glass frame containing a short newspaper clipping, yellow with age, two typewritten paragraphs of explanation, and the whorls of a dead man's thumbprint.
"Harry Jackson was the first man to be convicted in England because of fingerprint evidence," Sergeant Kane said. "Harry was a burglar. In the summer of 1902, he climbed through a window in Denmark Hill, stole some billiard balls and left his thumbprint in wet paint on the windowsill.
Sergeant Kane chuckled. Silly bugger. He got 7 years. I peered closer at the newspaper clipping. It was a letter to the Times, signed by someone calling himself a disgusted magistrate.
Sir, Scotland Yard, once known as the world's finest police organisation, will be the laughing stock of Europe if it insists on trying to trace criminals by the odd ridges on their skins.
8 years later, the rest of the world was catching up, said Kane. Thomas Jennings of Chicago became the first person in America to be convicted by fingerprint evidence.
Another burglar?
No, Jennings was a murderer. And soon the French were at it, nicking a reprobate by the name of Vincenzo Perugia. Doesn't sound very French, does he? On the basis of a left thumbprint.
What had he done?
He stole the Mona Lisa from the Louvre. Took the frogs 2 years to find him because they only had his right thumbprint on file.
I hear you solved your case. DCI Mallory will be very happy.
I nodded, staring at Harry Jackson's thumbprint. 20 years ago, a girl called Anya Bauer was the victim of a gang rape at Potter's Field, I said. The headmaster, Peregrine War, killed her to stop her talking. Bob the Butcher, Ian Peck, cut the throats of the men who had been the boys who attacked Anya. We got two murderers. We got their motives. The pieces all fit. The trouble is, John, when you look at them, those pieces don't make much sense.
Why not?
Peck is going to get life for Mallory's murder, I said, and his prints were everywhere in his parents' house.
I heard.
But they were not at the murder scenes of Hugo Buck, Adam Jones and Guy Phillips. The other murders, he confessed to, no prints there. Not even a partial, not even a glove print.
Yes, said Sergeant Kane, I heard that too.
But why would he lie? I said. Why would he, Ian Peck, confess to murders that he didn't commit?
Because he's nobody, said the keeper of the Black Museum, and he wants to be somebody. They're all the same. Serial killers, you think they're criminal masterminds? They're not Hannibal Lecter, Max. They're all just grubby little men. They're all psychopathic losers. Who are they? Albert DeSalvo, Peter Sutcliffe, and Ian Peck. They're germs, they're insects. But their crimes make them the Boston Strangler, the Yorkshire Ripper, and Bob the Butcher. It wouldn't surprise me if Bob the Butcher is standing up for murders that he didn't do. It's what Albert DeSalvo did. He wasn't even in jail for killing those 13 women in Boston. He was in jail for rape. That's the kind of vicious little woman-hating creep we're talking about. But then he becomes the Boston Strangler, and suddenly you got Tony Curtis playing you in a movie. I was staring at Harry Jackson's thumbprint. No prints, I said. Who has no prints, John? Sergeant John Kane of the Black Museum reached out and straightened the frame of his neglected Harry Jackson display.
Only a man with no hands, Max, he said.
Chapter 36. Midnight, on the school playing fields. The black silhouette of Potter's Field behind me, a jumble of towers and spires and architecture from the last 5 centuries. Blink your eye, and 100 years go by. It felt like the world was dead. I checked my phone one last time. No new calls, although I had left urgent messages for Whitestone, Gain, and Wren on my drive out here, and then began across the playing fields. The wind whistled through the trees in the distant woods, and I shuddered, as if the eyes of Anya Bauer were watching me. Soon you will be at rest, I thought. Soon you will be at peace, at last. There were no lights on in the little stone cottage, as I felt in my pocket for the headmaster's keys. The large set that looked like they were from a fairy tale, holding the key to every lock in every door in Potter's Field. There were 2 locks on the front door of the cottage, a standard Yale lock and a flush bolt. Nothing complicated. But I still had to try a dozen keys before the door swung silently open and I stepped inside. I stood there, listening for a moment, my eyes adjusting to the light,
slowing my breath, and then I quietly eased the door shut. On the table there was an empty teacup, a copy of the local newspaper, and a .410 shotgun. It was a small cottage, a servant's quarters given a quick coat of rural comfort. To the left was the bedroom and the bathroom, both doors shut. To the right, the small living area ran into an L-shaped kitchen, only large enough for one person at a time. I stood there, seeing in the darkness now, but not knowing what I was looking for until I glimpsed it under the sink. I moved quickly to the little kitchen, crouched down and pulled the door all the way open. An ancient leather bag was sitting with the bleach and disinfectant and insecticide. Its dark brown cowhide was worn and cracked, the brass hardware and locks blackened with rust. But somehow, you knew it was still being used. As something very small scuttled away in the skirting board, I reached in and took out the worn leather Gladstone bag. A murder bag. I turned to carry the bag back to the living space. And there he was. Old Len Zukov, sitting at the table with a .410 shotgun in his arthritic hands. I held up the bag for his inspection, as if he had asked me to retrieve it. "Your bag, Len," he sniffed. "Of course." I set it on the table, saying nothing. "You don't believe me," he said, the accent forever caught somewhere between rural England and his Russian homeland. "You'll never believe a word I say, do you?" I watched his hands on the .410. Despite his condition, the shotgun rested easily in his strong arms and those locked, arthritic fists. He was more comfortable than I had ever seen him. And I looked towards the door, wondering if the .410 was even loaded, and how much mobility he needed in his fingers to pull the trigger. Not much, I thought. The .410 is the lightest shotgun, often used for teaching children how to shoot. "Sit down now," he said, interrupting my calculations. "My colleagues will be here soon," I said, hearing the doubt in my voice. He liked that. "Perhaps not soon enough," he said. "I told you to sit down." I remained standing. "You didn't come forward to claim the body," I said. "Anya's body, Len. Anya Bauer. We know it was her remains in the grave with the dogs, no doubt about it. We obtained dental records from Germany. What stopped you coming forward and claiming the body? What were you afraid of? You knew her, Len." "Did you ever see what a shotgun does to a man's face?" he said. I joined him at the table. There were only two chairs. He wasn't one for doing a lot of socializing. "Poking around in the night," he said, shaking his head. "What you looking for?" He indicated the Gladstone bag that I'd placed on the table. "That old thing." "Not you," I said. "I'm not looking for you, Len." "Maybe you should be," he said, and he shifted the shotgun in his paralyzed hands. "Why don't you put the gun down, Len? Then we can talk." He gripped the .410 tighter. "You asked me how I came here," he said. "I came with the soldiers. I rode on the back of a T-34. Do you know the T-34? It was a tank in the war, the Second World War, the Great Patriotic War, you call it. The T-34 was a Russian tank." "No," he said. "The Russian tank. The T-34 was the Russian tank. The tank that bought you freedom. The tank that paid for your democracy. Britain, America. You said once that I was too young for the war. You were right. I was 11 years old. Too young for a war of annihilation. The Germans were coming, and I was in the fields, and I ran away. Then the Red Army took our town, and I returned. But the town was not there anymore, because we were subhumans to them. You understand? My mother, my father,
my grandmother, my sisters, subhumans. I never cried so much as at that time. The last days of my childhood passed in this way.
He was silent, lost in memory, or listening to the night.
I went west with our soldiers, he said. West, west, west. The first Belorussian. The Frontoviki, front-line troops, through a world in ruins. Do you know why they kept me? Because I had almost the same name as their leader, General Georgi Zhukov. What do you call it?
A mascot,
I said. A mascot. I wanted to live. I wanted to stay alive. But I wanted to see Germany destroyed. I closed my heart to pity.
He shook his head with wonder.
They had so much. The Germans were so rich. The farms, the animals. Why did they come to us when they already had so much?
They wanted more, Len, I said soothingly. They wanted the world. It was madness.
But he wasn't listening to me now. Our soldiers wanted women, he said. Frau, Frau, Frau. I wanted something else. For my dead family, for my grandparents, for my sisters, for my parents, for my gone family. Our Frontoviki placed me inside a cellar. One by one, a dozen Waffen-SS men who had destroyed their papers and ripped off their badges were sent inside. I could hear them screaming on the other side of the door. Nix SS, Nix SS. Our soldiers had shown me what to do. You know. The knife through the neck, then pull, then kick the Nazi down the stairs. A dozen of them. So, you see an old man, but you're looking at a killer.
We stared at each other.
I think it's been a while since you killed anyone, I said quietly. I think it's been a lifetime. He pointed the .410 at my face. You ain't the Germans, I said, but Anya Bauer was German, wasn't she? And you didn't hate Anya, did you? You loved her. Anya's father was German, he said, but her mother was Russian. My daughter. And Anya came to stay with you when she was 15 years old. Your granddaughter came to stay with you at Potter's Field. What was that? A summer holiday? Trouble at home? A bit of both? I bet there was some kind of trouble at home, wasn't there? Stop talking about her, he said. His voice flat and hard, levelling the .410 at my chest, giving himself a bigger target. And then one day, Anya was gone, I said. Somewhere between a missing person and a lost contact, and you didn't know what happened. Or maybe you suspected, but you were never sure until you saw what was in Henry's grave, when it was collapsing, when it was falling to bits. You saw her bones, didn't you? Human bones in there with the bones of Henry's dogs. Or maybe you saw them later, when the grave was being renovated. But at some point you saw inside the grave and you knew it had to be Anya. Shut up now, he said. The shotgun moving between my face and my chest. And you put it all together, I continued. Anya coming to stay, the boys who were sniffing around, Hugo Buck and his little gang, and then Anya gone, for a night, and then a year, and then forever. Were there rumours, Len? Did you hear anything about what Peregrine Wars followers had done to some girl? Were they afraid of the truth coming out? There must have been talk after James Sutcliffe killed himself, or pretended to. Somehow, you suddenly knew what had happened to her, what they had done, and you drew up a list of the boys who must have been in that room when war broke her neck, and they treated your beautiful girl like something to be thrown away, and you wanted revenge. Is that what happened? The .410 seemed to seek out my heart and stay there, steady at last in his paralysed hands. What matters, he said, what matters is that I avenged her. Do you believe me, at last? I believe all of it, Len, I said. I truly do.
except the last part. I don't believe that you've killed anyone since you were a boy. The door opened, and Tom Monk came in. An old army jacket slung over jeans, carrying a 12-bore shotgun and a lifeless brace of rabbits. Behind the terrible burns on his ruined face, I saw his eyes widen and grow cold.
Ah, he said, I was wondering when you might turn up.
A young policeman I know burned his hands when we collared Bob the Butcher, I said. A brave young lad called Billy Green. He was going to spend his sick leave in Las Vegas, champagne cocktails by the pool in Caesars, chorus girls, all that.
Very nice, Monk said.
But guess what? They wouldn't let him in. Sent Billy straight back to Gatwick, because the Americans fingerprint everyone at the border now, and they couldn't get any prints off him. Monk held up his hands, a mocking gesture of surrender, and for the first time I saw that the reason we could never find any prints at the crime scenes were because the flesh on his hands were as destroyed as the flesh on his face.
Remind me to steer clear of Las Vegas, he said.
So what's in it for you, Tom? I said. Keeping your hand in, spot of vigilante work. Never kick the killing habit. He stopped smiling.
Justice, he said.
I tried to smile, but my mouth merely twisted, and my heart began to hammer in my chest as I realized what was going to happen to me tonight.
You're right, he said. It's a joke. How can there be justice in a land where they let the bravest and the best sleep on the streets until they work up the nerve to top themselves?
So you cut the throats of Hugo Buck and Adam Jones, I said. Botched it with Piggy Phillips, didn't you?
Oh, I don't know, he said. I don't think he's going to be taking double game for a while, do you? But you missed out on Captain King, didn't you? The Taliban beat you to it.
Monk's mask-like face clenched with sudden fury.
You're just another stupid policeman. Captain King was a brave man, a warrior. One more lion led by yet more donkeys. Same story in this country for 100 years.
He leaned against the door and shook his head.
Captain Ned King was never on my list.
And what about Salman Khan? I said. Was he still alive when that big house went up in flames? Or did you break in there, open up his throat, and then torch the place?
One of his kids had a motorbike, Monk said. Have you ever heard of such a thing? A child with his own little motorbike. I served my country for 10 years, and all I've got is a second-hand bicycle.
What outfit were you with in Afghanistan, Tom?
I told you. The Royal Green Jackets.
I don't think so. You're too handy with a knife. Too good at creeping around. Unarmed combat and covering your tracks. I reckon you were with the Special Forces Support Group, or maybe the SAS or the SBS.
You calling me a liar?
I nodded. You're going to cut my throat, Tom? I said, knowing that was exactly what he was going to do.
Should have done it when I had the chance the first time.
I looked at the old man opposite. You should have gone to the police, Len. If you wanted justice for your granddaughter, you should have come to us, not waited for Rambo here to turn up.
Monk laughed. Who was going to get justice for Anya? Or for Len here? The police? The courts? You? You with your soft judges and weak laws and tricky lawyers selling rich man's justice? You with your bad back? Enough, Len said. And I turned my head just in time to see the old man shoot me in the chest.
The roar of the .410 split the air. I was blown backwards and over and flat on my back with my head in the open fireplace. The deafening sound of the .410 fired in a tiny space, still ringing somewhere deep inside my eardrums, and I was calling for Jesus and God to help me as my fingers scrabbled at my heart. The excruciating pain of 2 cracked ribs beneath massive bruising told me that I was not yet dead. The .410 shell had ripped a hole in my leather jacket and my T-shirt, but had not passed through the lightweight CV1 body armor. I kept calling for Jesus and God.
You're better off shooting him in the head,
Monk said. I need to go home now.
Yes, Len said. Go to them now. Go to your family. It is time. Your work here is done.
Thank you, my beloved friend. Thank you, my brother.
I struggled to sit up, but the pain in the top half of my body held me down. I could not move. Oh, God. Oh, Jesus. I realized that the chair I had been sitting on was underneath me, smashed to pieces.
I saw Zhukov kiss Tom Monk hard on the mouth, and I saw Monk leave the cottage without looking back. Len shuffled off to his bedroom, and when he came back, he had a box of shells with him. I saw him break the .410, laboriously push in a 3-inch red shell, then snap it shut. Oh, God. Oh, Jesus. He shuffled across to where I was lying and pointed the shotgun at my face. Oh, God. Oh, Jesus.
No!
Edie Wren was in the doorway. Len Zhukov swung the shotgun at her and paused.
Please, she said. What do you want? Talk to me. Please, talk to me, sir.
He looked at her face for a moment, and then, as if in answer, he placed the shotgun on the floor and, half crouching, set the barrel under his chin. I heard Edie scream, and I heard the shotgun roar. But then the darkness overwhelmed me, and the night was black. Chapter 37. We drove back to the city. DCI Whitestone at the wheel of my X5. D.I. Gain beside her in the passenger seat. Edie Wren and me in the back. Every time I was drifting off, thinking I might steal some sleep, the road rushing under our wheels and the white-hot pain in my cracked ribs shoved me awake. Sergeant Tom Monk came back from Afghanistan and he never went home, Whitestone said, her eyes not leaving the road ahead. I spoke to the people at Barrington Court. Monk returned from Helmand with a conspicuous gallantry cross and third-degree burns on his face and hands. He spent a few months in an ICU and then went to Barrington Court for his final rehab. Treatment for his burns, extensive physio. Therapy sessions with a psychoanalyst. The usual routine for a veteran with his injuries. When he had recovered, he stayed on helping out at Barrington Court, and they were glad for an extra pair of hands. Nobody seems to know what happened, but just before he was due to leave Barrington Court, Monk put on his dress uniform and had his photo taken at a small studio in Potter's Field High Street. Then he mailed the photo to his fiancée back in Stratford. Whitestone fell silent. I thought of the face that had been burned beyond recognition, and I thought of his girl back home, seeing a posed photograph of the damage for the first time. The road kept slipping past, lit by nothing but the high winter moon. Nobody knows if she ever wrote back or sent him a text, email, or message on Facebook. Monk never talked about it. Maybe she told him that it was over. Maybe she never contacted him again, and that told him all he needed to know. Who knows? But Monk never left Barrington Court. He stayed on, unpaid, unofficial, helping out with the rehab of other badly injured veterans, taking the men to Potter's Field for exercise. Where he met another soldier, I said. Len Zhukov, the start of a beautiful friendship.
I understand why Len Zhukov wanted payback for what they did to his granddaughter, Wren said, and I get why his friend would want to help him, but did Monk want to kill evil bastards, or did he just want to kill somebody?
Whitestone glanced at me in the rearview mirror. I had no answers. All I knew was that the state had trained Monk to be a killer, and in the end, that was all he had left, and all he could do, all he could offer, even when the state wanted him to stop. Edie, Whitestone said, some stuff we never get to know. You could see the piercing blue lights of our cars cutting up the night from a mile away. They illuminated the sleek, futuristic buildings of the Olympic Park and the urban wasteland that surrounded them. Now, monks, return to the place you go when you've run out of places to go, Whitestone said. He's finally come home. In the shadow of Olympic Park,
a dozen armed response vehicles surrounded a shabby block of flats that managed to be both modern and derelict. They were out of place in a neighbourhood where the buildings were either neat little flats and small houses that promised a nice life in the new East End, or they had been wiped from the face of the earth. It looked like the surface of the moon after a few years of serious gentrification. We lowered the windows of the X5 and dug out our warrant cards. Beyond the police tape, you could hear the digital cackle of the airwave radios, the occasional bark from one of the police dogs, and the shouts of officers who were pulled tight by nerves. Armed officers waited between the ARVs, their Heckler and Koch assault rifles held at their favourite 45-degree angle, butt high and business end pointing down, sweating hard in all that kit, despite the chill of the December night. They looked like the future. Tom Monk was standing alone on a scrappy patch of grass outside the block of flats, looking up, his gaze unswerving. And I saw now that there were half a dozen Glock 17 pistols pointing at the back of his head. They had evacuated most of the residents from the flats. In almost every window, the only signs of life were the fairy lights of Christmas, twinkling white and red and green. A young woman appeared briefly in one window, a toddler under her arm, and then she was gone. But Monk kept looking up at her window, even after the light in the room had gone out.
"That's her," said Edie Wren, and the tears on her face shone bright in the riot of flashing blue lights. "That's Monk's family, that poor girl, that poor man."
"No," DCI Whitestone said, "that's our killer. Let's nick the bastard." The armed officers stood aside as the K-9 unit came forward with their German shepherds. The handlers knelt by the flanks of their dogs, fingers scratching the back of those noble heads, whispering their final words of encouragement. Monk turned at the sound of the dogs. His old army coat swung open, and I saw his weapon sticking out of the lining, stuffed inside what looked like one of those big secret pockets that shoplifters use, the 12-bore shotgun that he had carried all the way from Potter's Field. Then voices were shouting all around and someone screamed, "I have the shot!" And Whitestone said, "Take the shot!" And the crack of gunfire tore the night, ripped it wide open, shockingly loud, one single shot that was so stretched out and jagged it made your heart leap. And Tom Monk was falling backwards, his head twisting sideways as if suddenly and savagely punched, the top of it flying away in a clump of blood and hair and skin and bone and brain. And then he was lying very still on a scrappy piece of grass, looking like what he was now, a fallen British soldier. I moved towards the lifeless body. Any hatred I had felt for him suddenly turned to a sour kind of sadness. But I felt Whitestone's hand on my arm, making me wait, taking no more chances. "Enough for one night, Max," she said. "It's almost Christmas." She gave the command, and they let loose the dogs. Chapter 38. Sunday morning. Scout sat at the window, waiting for her mother. Across the street, the great meat market at Smithfield was closed for the weekend, the crowds all gone, and the white dome of St. Paul's Cathedral rose above a scene of perfect stillness. On TV, the MP for Hillingdon North was entering 10 Downing Street, Siri Voss one pace behind, cradling a thick file of papers. Ben King smiled shyly at the journalists who called out to him.
"Congratulations on the promotion. A few words, Minister? The youngest parliamentary secretary to the Treasury in history. How does that feel? What kind of chief whip are you going to be, Mr. King? Are you going to put it about a bit? Are you going to give them some stick?"
There was a policeman on the door. King murmured good morning to him. The policeman touched his helmet in salute. Ben King and Siri Voss disappeared inside as a spasm of pain racked my lower back. Stan was sleeping at Scout's feet. But as I flinched, the dog stirred and stretched, downward-facing dog, then upward-facing dog,
all the while watching me with those massive round eyes, as if to say, "You must do the stretching every day of your life. Don't you even know that?" Or maybe he just wanted some food. In the pocket of my jeans, my phone began to vibrate, and then it was still, and then it began to vibrate again. I took it out and read the message from Anne, and I thought, there is no greater stranger than someone we used to love. "Angel," I said to Scout, with a lightness that I did not feel, "your mother's not coming today. Something came up. I'm sorry." Scout watched me with impassive eyes.
"She's very busy," my daughter said.
I nodded, and I could not tear my eyes from her as she went to the table and took out her box of pens and opened her drawing book. I walked over to her and watched her work for a bit. She was drawing Stan's head, and she had captured him very well. The bulging beauty of the eyes, the extravagant ears flowing like the hair of a girl in an old-fashioned painting, the nose like a squashed prune, the feathered glory of his tail. I touched her hand, and her eyes met mine. "Scout," I said, "it's just you and me now. But we're all right, aren't we?" She looked at her drawing, and then back at me.
"Yes," she said. "We're all right."
I breathed again. "Scout."
"What?"
"I'm very, very proud that you're my daughter." She got up and gave me an awkward embrace, her arm around my waist as I kissed her on top of her head. Then she broke off and went off to her bedroom, Stan trailing behind her, his tail up like a periscope. I turned to the TV as Ben King came out of number 10 and began walking towards the camera. Siri Voss was beside him, hugging her papers, but as they reached the camera, she stepped aside with a smile, waiting for him just out of shot. Ben King smiled. Then he cocked his head at the camera and looked into it the way he had so often looked at me. A penetrating, lopsided look, disarmed and disarming, as if he saw something in you the rest of the world had yet to see. Something glinted for a moment, but I couldn't tell if the fragment of light was on the TV screen or just inside my head. And then I realized that Ben King had a glass eye. And I saw that what James Sutcliffe had claimed was true. Someone had lost an eye in that room 20 years ago, a small forfeit for a young girl's life. But it wasn't Hugo Buck. How had I missed it? "You," I thought, as Ben King smiled for the cameras in Downing Street. "You." And I saw a vision of two boys at a breakfast table, twin brothers, arguing with a fury that neither of them had known before, identical in every way apart from their hearts. And one of the brothers threw a glass with full force at the other's face, and I knew it wasn't Ned who was in that basement room the night they stole Anya Bauer's life. It was his brother, Ben.
"Daddy,"
Scout said. She was holding the junior boxing gloves I had bought her, one of those unsuccessful presents that parents so often buy for their children, when they still hold on to the vain hope that their mutual interests might possibly coincide, one of those presents that are admired for the sake of politeness and then tossed into a drawer never to be seen again.
"I want to know how," she said. "Show me."
I helped her to put on the gloves. They were the smallest size available, and they were still comically enormous on her, but we did not smile. I held up my palms. "When you throw a punch," I said, "it should be like catching a fly. You ever catch a fly?" She shivered.